Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This is the John Fugelsang Podcast.
I want to start off with a little poem, if I may, in honor of Half Done Day. Today is Half Done Day. I don't know if you know about this, sort of my great pumpkin thing I'm trying to start. Every year is halfway over on June 30th and or July 1st. So 2022, half done. Please, please join me in building this movement and make Half Done Day our culture's next totally unnecessary heavy drinking holiday for no reason. I can see cards. I mean, they're already trying to ruin Juneteenth. Let's do the same thing to Half Done Day, shall we? We're going to be talking tonight about today's one day in the Supreme Court. One day that summed up everything in the entire term at the Supreme Court. The good, the bad, and the batshit. It's quite an experience. Also, hello to everybody listening on demand on the SiriusXM app and on the John Fugelsang podcast. I want to, since we're coming up on the 4th of July weekend, want to just open with a little poem. Little Dr. Seuss book, because I like to write Dr. Seussian kinds of things. And, you know, everyone says, well, what are we going to tell the children? What are we going to tell the children about abortion? How do you, are you talking to your kid about abortion? And I thought, okay, well, that's a fair question. I mean, you know, I guess I should talk to my child about abortion. So I figured, well, the way to do it is a poem, like a Dr. Seuss-style poem that I'm hoping to publish, to find a tasteful way to explain to our children how complex this issue is and how nuanced both sides are. So if you'll allow me to open it a very different way, this is my way of explaining to kids the tough emotional and moral choices on both sides of the debate. This poem's called Pro-Lifers Will Fucking Kill Us All. When they say they're pro-life, it's important, you see, they're not referring to you or to me. Make abortion a crime. That's the issue they dote on. It's not in the Bible, but it's all that they vote on. They're pro-torture, pro-drone bombs, pro-preemptive wars. They play dumb about COVID as the body count soars. And the planet really is getting warmer, y'all. These pro-life people, they will kill us all. They don't want mandates. They don't want vaccines. They want all to have access to AR-15s. Herd immunity. Last season they preached it. This year they're the reason we're not going to reach it. They live in the suburbs. They live in the woods. They don't all wear masks, but some do wear hoods. Their leader said we should inject Lysol. These pro-life people really will kill us all. And they love to see a condemned man frying. They don't mind pollution. They're science denying. They believe men who lied to us in a pandemic. They don't believe racism's ever systemic. They don't care about our air or a safe carbon cap. They won't offer a prayer for the poor kids on SNAP. If men could get pregnant, they'd give abortions at the mall. But they can't. So pro-lifers will kill us all. In a desperate time of conflict and strife, some empty suit candidate says he's pro-life, but he's not here to help these gullible folk. And the pro-lifers cheer. They're not in on the joke. He'll rip them all off. That don't matter to Cletus. We don't care about no people. We're just here for the fetus. Now the party of Lincoln's a satanic cabal, and pro-lifers will, bloody well, kill us all. Abortion's their thing. They've been raised to resent 'em, but they never got taught about how to prevent them. They're not fans of sex ed being taught as a whole, or easier access to safe birth control. No, overturn Roe is the one holy grail. After that, they'll just have to put women in jail. They think they're ending abortion. I think they will find they have only prevented the safe, legal kind. The writing's already up there on the wall. And these godless pro-life folks, they will kill us all. Pro-life Christians, the most exceptional on earth. They'll protect you from conception till the moment of your birth. But they only mention Jesus in the manger, or arisen, not the guy who fought for poor folks and the sick and those in prison. Who railed against the rich for taking more than their fair portion, who opposed all executions, never once talked about abortion. If he came back, he'd say, they know not what they do. Then they'd probably just fucking kill Jesus too. Thank you. I am available for children's parties. And before I talk about the Supreme Court today, and I want to get to your calls, it's an anniversary. 36 years ago today, Bowers v. Hardwick was decided. That's where the Supreme Court upheld, 5-4, the Georgia state law banning sodomy. For those of you who don't know, sodomy refers to a despicable, horrible, evil thing done between gay men, or a thing done between straight men and really awesome, wonderful, understanding women. That ruling was overturned by the court 17 years later in Lawrence v. Texas. But today's the actual anniversary of the Reagan court essentially criminalizing gay sex between consenting adults, Bowers v. Hardwick, which upheld the constitutionality of the Georgia sodomy law, criminalizing oral and anal sex in private between consenting adults, but only when applied to gay people. The majority opinion was written by Byron White, who said the Constitution did not confer a fundamental right to engage in homosexual sodomy. Chief Justice Warren Burger talked about the ancient roots of prohibition against gay sex, quoting Blackstone's description of gay sex as an infamous crime against nature, worse than rape and a crime not fit to be named. Can you imagine if these guys were here today, the disgusting shit that would be on their hard drives? Harry Blackmun, who was the hero of Roe v. Wade, he framed the issue in his dissent as revolving around the right to privacy, which is what brings us to today's big issue. Blackmun's dissent accused the court of, in his words, an almost obsessive focus on homosexual activity and an overall refusal to consider the broad principles that have informed our treatment of privacy in specific cases. And they brought up all these religious taboos against homosexuality, none of which, by the way, come from Jesus. And Blackmun wrote that certain but by no means all religious groups condemn the behavior at issue gives the state no license to impose their judgments on the entire citizenry. The legitimacy of secular legislation depends instead on whether the state can advance some justification for its law beyond conformity to religious doctrine. I wish we had a Harry Blackmun on the court today. And by the way, William Rehnquist, Sandra Day O'Connor, they all voted for this as well. You know who dissented? Harry Blackmun, William Brennan, Thurgood Marshall, and John Paul Stevens. All considered heroes today, all of them view the law as unconstitutional. Right to privacy. Does that remind you of any recent rulings? Let's talk about today's, because the two scariest words in the English language are actually numbers. 6-3. And the latest 6-3 decision was West Virginia versus the EPA. And you can argue that what they did today might be even worse than what they did with Roe. It's hard to say. Roe's going to make the lives of women and the men who love them a lot more difficult. But what they did today with West Virginia v. EPA, that's going to make the lives of everyone on the planet potentially a lot more difficult. And it was the culmination of decades of right-wing politicians trying to make sure the federal government can't use clean air and water to threaten the status quo of business. This ruling today limits how the nation's main anti-air pollution law, the Clean Air Law, can be used to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from power plants. Washington Post had an interesting headline. They said, justices limit EPA power to combat climate change, a blow to Biden's agenda. It's not often I say this, Washington Post, but that's a really stupid headline. It's not a blow to Biden's agenda. It's a blow to life on this planet. Rolling Stone had a headline saying Supreme Court rules 6-3 that the planet should burn. It's all about whether the EPA can regulate emissions. And it does still leave room for the EPA to regulate emissions, but it was a big victory for the coal industry today. It was their last stand against any kind of pollution regulation. Elena Kagan, dissented hard, and she wrote, "Let's say the obvious. The stakes here are high. Yet the court today prevents congressionally authorized agency action to curb power plants' carbon dioxide emissions. The court appoints itself, instead of Congress or the expert agency, the decision maker on climate policy. I cannot think of many things more frightening. Respectfully, I dissent." Democrats and people of good conscience who care about air and water are terrified now. They've been trying to pass legislation to fight climate change, and it's been blocked over and over and over by Republicans and more recently by a couple of Democratic senators I could name. And the party has not been able to garner 50 votes in the Senate they would need to move climate legislation because of Joe Manchin, who has gotten very wealthy off of coal. The White House said President Biden will not relent in using the authorities he has under law to protect public health and tackle the climate change crisis. "Our lawyers will study the ruling carefully. We will find ways to move forward under federal law." They did, however, and here's the good, the Supreme Court did something that surprised us. They cleared the way for the Biden administration to stop sending migrants back to Mexico. For now, 5-4 decision, they ruled that federal immigration law does not mandate that the administration has to send asylum applicants back to Mexico, even though Donald Trump had this really shitty and dangerous Remain in Mexico program. It leaves intact for now the government's authority to release or parole foreign citizens into the U.S. while they await their immigration or court hearings. It doesn't rule out the possibility there'll be other legal challenges to this, but, you know, it's actually pretty promising. They found the Department of Homeland Security had the authority to end enforcement of the migrant protection protocols, which is what Trump called Remain in Mexico. That's the policy that allows border agents to take people who are legally seeking asylum in our country, which is not against the law, and just dump them to Mexico while they wait for their proceedings in the U.S. to be adjudicated. This already forced more than 71,000 asylum seekers back onto Mexican soil while Trump was president. And of course, those who got turned back often faced very dangerous conditions. A lot of them were at high risk of trafficking, exploitation, and murder. Blanca Lomeli, director of the Mexican branch of HIAS, which provides humanitarian aid to refugees, said, "People on MPP we serve suffer from anxiety, stress, and a sense of hopelessness and often helplessness. Immigration groups are very happy about this. And in his first days in office, you might remember, Joe Biden told Homeland Security to evaluate the policy. They stopped enforcing it in February of last year. 6 months later, a Texas judge said, nope, you got to reimplement it. So today, the Supreme Court came down on the side of, well, decency. I'm sure all of you MAGA Christians are really happy that these Christian refugees at our border are going to be able to wait here in America while they wait for their asylum, right? MAGA Christians, this is what Jesus talked about. He didn't mention abortion, talked about welcoming the stranger. I'm sure you're, hello, anyone? MAGAs? Also, in very good news, Chief Justice John Roberts administered the oath to Ketanji Brown Jackson as her husband, Patrick Johnson, held the Bible. We saw Justice Breyer announce yesterday that he'd be leaving office at noon today. So rather than waiting until the fall, they swore her in. It was a very moving moment. It was a very historically important moment. I don't know if you got to see it. Here's a little bit of audio from Ketanji Brown Jackson being sworn in today, making history and giving a silver lining to a very bad week, joining the Supreme Court as an associate justice.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Ketanji Brown Jackson, do solemnly swear.
I, Ketanji Brown Jackson, do solemnly swear.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
That I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I'm about to enter.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I am about to enter.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Thank you very much. And now I'll turn things over to Justice Breyer.
Good. The judicial oath, will you raise your right hand, please? Thank you. I, Ketanji Brown Jackson.
I, Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will administer justice.
That I will administer justice
without respect to persons.
Without respect to persons.
And do equal right.
And do equal right
to the poor and to the rich.
To the poor and to the rich.
And that I will faithfully and impartially.
And that I will faithfully and impartially
discharge and perform.
Discharge and perform
all the duties.
All the duties
incumbent upon me.
Incumbent upon me.
As an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States.
As an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Under the Constitution.
Under the Constitution.
And laws of the United States.
And laws of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
I wanted to play the whole thing because it made me so happy. And thank you, Justice Breyer, for your years of service. As of now, guys, as of today, there is only one Supreme Court justice left on the bench who was appointed in the 20th century. And it's Clarence Thomas. And he was appointed by George H.W. Bush, who opposed the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Finally, I promised you the good, the bad. Here's the batshit. The conservative justices declined to hear a religious liberty challenge to New York's COVID-19 vaccine mandate from 16 healthcare workers. New York State requires all healthcare workers show proof of vaccination because they're not fucking homicidally stupid. Clarence Thomas, however, is homicidally stupid, and he suggested the vaccines are derived from the cells of aborted children. Yes, Clarence Thomas said they object, these 16 healthcare workers, on religious grounds to all available COVID-19s because they were developed using cell lines derived from aborted children. None of the COVID-19 vaccines available here in the U.S. contain cells of aborted children. If you don't believe me, you're welcome to Google that. My God, help us all. Louie in Florida. Thanks for waiting on hold.
John, I love your poem. I've got a new 7-month baby granddaughter. I will read that to her knowing she won't know what the fuck I'm saying, and but maybe it'll subliminally sink in.
Okay. Please do. We're going to try and get it published, so thank you.
And the other thing is, everyone listening, and I hope you do this as a weekly segment, I'm in Florida. We are a purple state. Charlie Crist, who I think will end up being the nominee, we can beat DeSantis. I think the gas prices are going down. I think the Saudi Arabian king is going to get read privately the riot act by Biden. You know what? I'm going to pull our military out of here, and you don't expect the Soviets or Europe to come in to help you when Iranian freaking gunboat hit the beach here. So what I want you to do is pump 2 million more barrels of oil a day. And that, plus us releasing another million barrels to make our daily release from the oil reserve 2 million, we could drop the price of oil. And I know that my environmentalist friends, that I'm an environmentalist, this is not good in the long term. But it's the short term to keep that shit crazy out of the White House, out of this. If we could keep that House and the Senate, which would be, I wanted to say a miracle, but now with the abortion ruling, and I see young women finally getting motivated and activated and maybe voting en masse. I think there's a chance we could win the House, keep the House, and gain seats in the Senate. That's a wish, but I think it's a plausible wish.
I think it's plausible, too. Look, it's plausible if people vote. If there's high turnout, Democrats win. That's always the rule. It's always true. When there's low turnout, Republicans win because, well, the status quo got to be the status quo by being so organized. I do want to correct you on one thing. One thing. I don't really know if Joe Biden is going to grab the Saudi king by the lapels and say, does Joe Biden need to smack a bitch? We pulled all of our troops out of there back in 2004. We pulled all of our troops out of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, but we're in Qatar. We're in Bahrain. I'm a former Marine. You know that. We are still in Kuwait. So what it is like we will pull out of the Gulf states. We've got a tremendous 7th Fleet presence in Qatar.
I know.
Tremendous Army presence in Kuwait. So all of that is a stopgap that possibly prevents Iran from coming in. All I want to do is scare the guy and going, what if we bailed out on you guys?
I like the idea of scaring the Saudi king. I don't think it's actually going to happen. And you're right to point out that we do have troops all over the region. But, you know, let's never forget Don Rumsfeld and Bush gave bin Laden exactly what he wanted. I mean, one of the reasons bin Laden had the attack on 9/11 was because of our troops in the Holy Land. And after we invaded Iraq, they pulled all the troops out. So that was that's what we call a capitulation and appeasement.
So, well, we'll see. I'm just hoping that I do think the Saudis are going to up some production in oil. I heard 250,000 barrels a day, which is not enough, but I think it could happen. And I'm wishful thinking, and I got voodoo dolls, Ouija boards. I got everything. I'm going to do whatever it takes.
Well, and get a voodoo doll for Vladimir Putin, because he is still, you know, not as dramatically as Biden implies, but Vladimir Putin is still very much to blame for the high gas prices. And keep in mind also, the gas prices will probably be down by 2024 election time, but no one in our government is willing to take on the oil companies, because the price of a barrel of oil is not that much different than it was 10 years ago, and yet the price is so huge. Why we are still giving hundreds of millions in subsidies to big oil is beyond my logic and morality.
The one thing about high prices of gas right now is electric car sales are through the roof. You cannot get an electric F-150. You can't get an electric Ford. Tesla is like still running their factories at mass capacity. So that the high price, which is the environmentalists like the high price of gas. I do, in a way, I'm doing Uber now, which sucks because Uber's not paying us fucking anything extra. Like 55 a ride is bullshit. But I don't rely on Uber. I'm a retiree. I've got disability income. I got a small pension. Uber's my fun money, but it really not quite fun money. That some of it I really hate. But there are people that live on Uber. A lot of immigrants that don't speak English.
Oh, I know it. And they're the ones getting hurt by the gas prices. And, you know, I do appreciate environmentalists who think, OK, well, there'll be less fossil fuel production and consumption if we have higher gas prices. But the fact is, high gas prices are like fare hikes in public transportation. It's always a tax on poor people. Always.
It is. And so we need subsidies on electric cars for.
I think so.
People.
Oh, I completely think so. I think any businesses that are contributing to the destruction of our air and water and soil can kiss their subsidies goodbye. I also think that we should, you know, take all the tax breaks away from every business that ship their manufacturing overseas. For God's sakes,
and
people,
one last
it's not
thing,
that hard.
John,
yeah.
Please, every week until the election, pick a state like Florida or Georgia and just do a 10-minute rant on registering people to vote. Bringing your friends to the polls. This election is base election, as all midterm elections are, and we need to rally our base. Use the abortion issue with young people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, whatever you got to do, get your cousins out. And your MAGA cousins, tell them the election was canceled this year.
That's not fair. I'm going to tell all my MAGA cousins that even though I disagree with them, I hope they show up to vote on the first Wednesday in November. I'm going to let them all know.
Perfect.
Thank you so much, Louis.
Thank you.
Happy 4th of July to you. We're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, the great Kenneth C. Davis on the 4th of July and all your calls. We will get to all your calls this evening, and I will thank you for your patience, and we will be right back.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Is So here's the big flowery introduction. And it's always daunting to introduce you because you know how it is for someone in my position. Like, where do I start? Like, how many credits do I slip into this thing? Like, how, I mean, there's so many films.
There's a lot. Yeah.
I mean, there's Birdie and there's Shortcuts. I always include Shortcuts and, you know, and The Band Played On, and there's Vision Quest, and of course, Dark Knight Rises. Yeah, Full Metal Jacket. I think that's the name of the film. There's that one. You know, there's Cutthroat Island. There's the work on stage. There's your work as a director. There's your work as a fearlessly political artist who cares about the community that produced him. And then, of course, the millions of new fans you have generated as Dr. Brenner on Netflix's Stranger Things, the only flesh and bone villain on the show who died. Or was he, or did he? That's sort of
that's the question.
Yeah. What a pleasure to welcome back actor and director and New York City cyclist and a hero of my union, Matthew Modine.
Thank you very much. So nice to be here, John.
It's so good to see you again. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm so happy that you are doing this tour because the character is not dead. I know that for years there was some kind of question of was he dead or was he not? Mm. But I guess we've learned from this show, if you don't see the body, the character is not gone.
Yeah, that's what the Duffer brothers said. The question that people are asking now is, how did he survive the Demogorgon? Mm-hmm. How did he survive Vecna, you know, when he went mm-hmm. and killed all the kids? And in the scene with Millie Bobby Brown, when she tries to use her power against him, he simply says, "You didn't think it was going to be that easy, did you?" And so who is this guy? What's happening? What's going on there?
Well, and we're not giving anything away if
no,
people haven't seen
no,
the new
that's
season
all,
yet.
No, that yeah. all happened in the... Well, if they haven't seen the first half of volume four, season
yeah.
four. Yeah.
Well, here's what got me, because you're one of the reasons I don't give up on Twitter. And I was reading your Twitter like a week ago, 2 weeks ago, and you printed this. One of the elders of the city said, "Speak to us of good and evil." And he answered, "Of the good in you I can speak, but not of the evil. For what is evil but good, tortured by its own hunger and thirst? Mm. Verily, when good is hungry, it seeks food even in dark caves." And I was like, that's Khalil Gibran, right?
Yeah.
And who I love. And I just was like, oh, he's talking about this character.
Yeah, I was talking about
you were.
Brenner, yeah.
Because I think if they're going to bring him back, the most interesting thing they can do in service to the character and the story is to not let him be a simple figure of menace and fear, but actually to be a human, to actually be a bit more of a complex character than maybe we thought based on season one.
Yeah, I agree with you, John. That's why I put that out there. It's the funny thing about it is how things come full circle. I studied acting just around the corner from here mm-hmm. at the City Center with a wonderful woman named Stella Adler.
Oh, I'm going to get to her.
And one of the books that when we came into class that she told us to go out and buy and read was The Prophet. I didn't know how to pronounce. I'm still not sure how to say Khalil, Gibran.
I've always said Gibran. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, there's different pronunciations.
We did a reading at my wedding, and I should have checked that before I did.
Yeah, we have to ask a Lebanese person. But that was the book she had us read, and we were all, you know, enthusiastically flipping through the book, wondering what does this have to do with acting? What, you know, that doesn't make any sense. Why read this book about this prophet and these teachings, these spiritual teachings? And you realize that Stella knew that in order for you to be an actor, you had to understand what it was to be human. That this shared experience that we all have, that we exist within these bodies, and the body is what separates us. But when we connect on a different level outside of this materialism is spirituality. And in the world of the spirit that Khalil Gibran is speaking of in The Prophet, we are all united. All of the energy of the universe is united in that spirituality. And it's what we have to be sort of taking steps towards and evolving to end these endless wars, to end this inhumanity to each other. But it's easier said than done, you know, because materialism is so powerful. It's so I mean, remember when 9/11 happened and George W. Bush was standing on the pile and told people to go shopping, you know, and what you and I, because we've had these conversation, this conversation, that I don't know how to say it. The resources of our planet are finite. They're not mm-hmm. infinite. And we are consuming at an unsustainable pace. And we are producing more waste than the world knows how to digest. And we have what the film that when we were kids, Koyaanisqatsi, that Life Out of Balance. And we have to do something really urgently and very quickly, or life as we know it is going to be unrecognizable.
Well, that's the interconnectedness, isn't it? That brings together spirituality and politics and the environment and art.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a great track on the Johnny Cash Unearthed box set. And it's studio dialogue, the only piece of studio dialogue where Rick Rubin has given him a copy of Khalil Gibran's The Prophet. Mm. And he's asking this old Baptist, Johnny Cash, in his 70s, what he thought of it. Yeah. And for Cash, it was transformative. And Rick Rubin just rolled on it. You can hear it. It's on the box set Unearthed. And Rick Rubin just included this bit of them talking about the book, The Prophet.
Wow.
For me, it was important at the time because there was such incredible anti-Muslim sentiment from people who claim to be Christians. Mm. And it was all linked together. And I will bring this back to Stranger Things, but I think you're saying that spirituality is the thing that does connect all living beings. Mm-hmm. Is that what you believe?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what it is.
It is.
So bringing it back to the Monster Show, that's what I found so interesting about the character, because I couldn't help but feel that you had not just lobbied to bring him back, but that you had lobbied for him to be more than just a villain. Because villains don't exist in real world.
Yeah, I didn't like that the reason that I was chosen to play the part was because I believe that I'm innately good and I want to make the world a better place. So it's very attractive to filmmakers to take somebody who's really good and have them become somebody who's really bad.
Yeah.
Because it's more horrible. It's like, why is that good person who seems like a good person doing such evil things?
It's interesting. It's, I mean, yeah. Sergio Leone wanted Henry Fonda to play a murderer in the Western. Yeah,
exactly. So I felt exploited. And so I was always defending Dr. Brenner and saying, but he's not, you know, he loves his children. And, you know, when I embrace that boy at the first 8 minutes of season one, that was a choice. That was that he loved that boy. And we didn't get to see that with Brenner and Eleven, because it was what we got to explore this season was the origin of how did we get there. And the Duffer brothers always said to me, no, Brenner's bad.
He is responsible for a lot of death.
He is, yeah.
But he's not the cliche mad scientist. Now, you just as an actor would want to imbue him with all the humanity you could, because that's the job. No one plays Richard III as a villain and gives an interesting performance of Richard III. You can't just be, hey, let's be evil. Yeah. So, I mean, it actually gives me pause, because don't you enjoy playing a sinister character and being able to not just have the fun of it, but to go through the workout of imbuing the humanity in a character which on the page is just a bad guy?
Yeah, I don't enjoy it. Because I feel like when I come home after playing, I want to take a shower and kind of wash it off. Daniel Day-Lewis he's not a close friend, he's a friend. And I know afterward he like shaves his head because he wants to cut that character off, that whatever it was. I mean, particularly with There Will Be Blood.
Yeah.
That was a guy that you really probably wanted to fast and cut things off.
Yeah, the boxer too. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a really bad guy.
Yeah.
And so my father was a drive-in theater manager, and I grew up watching so many movies. And what I wanted to be was an agent for change, you know, that I didn't want to be the person who was responsible for the problem. I wanted to be the person who was solving the problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so to be find myself being a person who's really causing the problem, playing that person, imbuing that character, it's not something I don't enjoy it. So I just try to fill him with as much love and confuse the audience as much as I can.
That's why I've been looking forward to talking about this character with you and this new incarnation of him, because again, he is trying to exploit and weaponize this child's power. He is responsible for the deaths of a lot of kids, but it seems that the team understands that solidifying his relationship with L is what is going to actually make us care for him for the first time, because you were a menace in season one, and then we just saw you in flashback, and then not seeing you in season three. I just love the choice to bring him back and make him a whole new character.
Yeah,
the same guy we knew, but now we're going to actually know him.
Yeah, I'm really anxious to see what's going to happen in this volume two. The next episode that people will see is called Papa, and I have not seen it. I mean, obviously, I played it and I read it and brought it to life, but I don't know, because the Duffers are very clever. You know, we may have shot some things that, because there are a lot of people that work on the show, to confuse them so that should something be leaked, they may be
really
leaking, it may be leaking information.
Oh, you may have done that.
We did.
Oh, you did. Yeah.
But I don't know how they'll cut those pieces together. So
you don't even know. That's great.
I don't know. When we did Dark Knight Rises, they shot a scene where Batman was dead. Yeah, Bruce Wayne was dead, and there was a funeral scene, and they were burying the body. And they put Christian Bale there standing with Michael Caine, just in the, like a few feet away, so that they could remove him. Or maybe he was just outside the frame of the camera. But they shot it because they knew there were paparazzi that were photographing things. So it couldn't be Christian Bale that was buried, because Christian Bale was standing there.
Right.
So they have to. We live in a different world today, with, you know, somebody can take a photograph and post it on social media, and the entire world knows within a few minutes.
You make me think of your character in that film, because he was also a character who was a good guy and yet an antagonist at the same time.
Yeah.
And I always thought in many ways he was the most nuanced character in the film. He, not unlike Bruce Wayne, this good guy who's a bad guy, who's a good guy who's a bad guy.
Yeah. I feel like in Dark Knight Rises, my character is the only one that had what we call a character arc.
He sure does.
A beginning, a middle, and an end.
With the redemption.
Yeah. Yeah, he shows up.
You know, volume four of Stranger Things has now broken the record as the biggest premiere weekend ever for an English language TV show. And it makes me think that you went from this childhood of growing up around drive-in theaters, then you became a film and television and stage actor, and now you're in the biggest streaming show of all time. What do you think of the evolution of how we tell stories using screens?
Yeah, it's so different. So I've been saying 162 territories. It's actually 190 territories that Netflix is in out of 196. And so, you know, if you take all of my films sort of together, if a film was successful in 60 territories around the world in the 80s, that was a tremendous success. You know, 60 territories, it was a number one film in 60 territories. So to have a show that's in 190 territories and I don't know how many different languages, it's a kind of success that I don't think other human beings have existed maybe in the history of entertainment, that to be that.
Yeah.
I mean, Charlie Chaplin was probably one of the biggest stars in the history of this business, and I don't think that his success at anywhere touches what things are capable of, like Squid Games, you know, being the big billion and a half hours of viewing that people have watched Squid Games, some number like that. So I'm hoping that Volume 2 puts us over the, because you mentioned English language,
yes,
the most watched, that we'll catch Squid Games and be just the most watched. That would be cool.
I mean, what has surprised you the most about the vastness of the popularity of this show, especially because this season's not screwing around. It's a horror show from the very first scene you're in at the top of the season. What surprised you the most about just the enormity of the fan base for this?
I don't understand. You know, John, I've tried to figure this out now. I've done over 120 movies and television shows and worked on Broadway and in Chicago and London on the stage. Every time I start a project, I start with the same enthusiasm and excitement and think that this could be really great and really fantastic. And the crews have the same equipment. They have cameras or film cameras or digital cameras, lights, sound equipment, enthusiastic crews and art departments and hair and makeup and costumes. Everybody works together to put this thing together. And sometimes it works. And sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes people are able to photograph and it's magical and transformative. And other times it's just flat. I don't understand why or how that happens. You know, that's the magic of show.
Yeah, I agree. But you've always got to bring the same commitment and the same enthusiasm to every project.
100%.
Are there films that you have worked on that you are just baffled didn't find the audience they deserved?
Yeah. One of the that you mentioned, Cutthroat Island.
Yeah.
I had such a good time making that movie. Gina Davis was wonderful to work with. The other actors that worked on the film.
It's a terrific role for you.
We had such a good time making that movie. And when it was critically panned, I sort of felt like we had, you know, it was being viewed upon as though we had tried to remake Gone with the Wind or something. You know, it was just a pirate movie that was designed to be fun. I think it was a little bit too early on the curve of, you know, people weren't prepared to have Gina Davis as a woman leading an action movie. I don't think that if you release, excuse me, if you release the film today, it might be, you know, completely differently received, you know, by the audience. I don't know what it was, but it was just a pirate movie. It was just really fun. I think it's better than the Johnny Depp Pirates of the Caribbean. It's just all of the, there's no visual effects in the movie. When we blew a ship up.
No, it's amazing. I think at the time there was a certain industry or media bias against the director.
Yeah.
And I think that colored a lot of the reviews of the product itself, actual work, because it certainly found an audience in cable.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. It did, yeah.
Are there any, it's 35 years this week since a low-budget indie film called Full Metal Jacket opened in theaters. Speaking of films that you probably knew were special while you were making them, are there any stories you haven't told
about Full Metal Jacket?
Yeah, because you wrote a wonderful book about the experience. Yeah. Your photographs that you've shown have been brilliant. I've never seen you do an interview where someone doesn't Kubrick out on you.
Yeah.
I don't think it's burdensome for you to have to talk about it all the time, but are there any stories you haven't told? Do you ever get tired of telling the same?
Sure there's a story I haven't told.
I love the Val Kilmer story. I love the anecdotes. Yeah. And the story of your wife going into labor is just an astonishing story about Kubrick and about logic itself.
Just he wouldn't let me go to the hospital. He's, you know, so I had to threaten him with cutting my hand open and having to go to the hospital to have my hand stitched closed.
But he had logic about why you shouldn't go there. Wasn't he saying, you'll be in the way?
Well, he said that, I'll be in the way. You know, if she's having an emergency cesarean, I would pass out if I saw once they cut her open and the blood was spilling on the floor. Then he went into further logic about how a child doesn't even need a father for the first year of its life, that it just wants its diaper changed and a boob, you know, to drink milk. But yeah, I don't know, some story that I've never told about Kubrick.
But you, I think you pulling out the knife was actually being logical right back in his face,
yeah,
I always thought.
Yeah, yeah. He couldn't believe that, I mean, the shock on his face that I was actually considering cutting my hand open.
Do you think he respected it?
I think he did, yeah. I think he... Emotion was something that he had a kind of, I believe, struggled with, the human emotion, and it's why he couldn't figure actors out, that they were, you know, because it's such a technical process, you know, memorizing lines, hitting marks, you know, the costumes, the makeup, all of that is very controllable. But then there was this human emotion that was so tricky, and how do you control it? And how do you, I mean, we see in the great documentary that Stanley Kubrick's daughter, Vivian Kubrick, made in the making of The Shining, and how he was able to really crush the spirit and the soul of Shelley Duvall, and, you know, how he treated her. But I believe this is something I don't think I've ever talked about. You know, Stanley wanted to make a movie about Napoleon for decades, and he had card cataloged every moment that he was able to about Napoleon's life. That, you know, he had a card catalogs like in the old library.
He wanted Brando for it, didn't he?
A whole bunch of people. Nicholson.
That's
he talked
right,
to
yeah.
Nicholson. Several actors, but he trying to understand the journey of this man's life. And by the way, had Napoleon, the project, existed in this time of Netflix or streaming services, Stanley would have been able to make it, because what he was never going to be able to do was make a self-contained story about Napoleon the way he wanted to in a feature film, that it was something that needed to be serialized over a season or two seasons.
Like a Barry Lyndon, just let it be as long as it needs to be.
Yeah. And it's unfortunate that Stanley passed away before the advent of Netflix, because I'm sure we'd all be enjoying Stanley Kubrick's Napoleon right now.
But it's true that he was quite collaborative on set for all of the, I mean, for all of the famed, you know, difficulties with human emotions, which comes in handy in a thing like 2001. But he was very collaborative with the actors in terms of setting up the shots.
Very collaborative. He said he could never knew where to put the camera until the actors did the scene. So he didn't have a preconceived storyboarded idea of how to make the movie. He needed to see the actors really do the scene. And that would reveal the place to put the camera. It, does the camera have movement? What lens to put on the camera? He hadn't pre-lensed the movie. He hadn't pre... Of course, I'm sure he pre-visioned it. He had it in his imagination about how he would shoot it, how it would come together. But he really needed the actors to go through that. And again, it brings us back to that emotional life. And what I was going to say about Napoleon is that I think that the true 100% fascination that he had with Napoleon was that this great general, this unbelievable strategist, maybe the most famous combatant in the history of the world, could be brought down by emotion, you know, and his love for Josephine. I think that that's what it was. And I think that that's what's in Eyes Wide Shut.
Mm-hmm.
Is
that, I do too.
That this, you know, this, it's interesting. This is something that your audience won't know, is Nicole Kidman is dressed like Stanley Kubrick's wife in the film. She wears the same clothing. She wears the same glasses. Christian, his wife's paintings are on the wall.
I knew that.
And I think that, you know, I'm sure that Stanley had smoked some joints in his life, and he came home. And I don't know if you know any German people. German tend to be much more open about sex and conversations about sex. It's a, you know, we're Puritans over here on this side of the ocean. And over there, it's just something people actually have sex and have children. Mm-hmm. That's what they do. And sometimes they just have sex for enjoyment, you know. Yeah. Can you believe those crazy Germans? And so Stanley's married to this German girl. And maybe they smoked some pot and they were at a party and came home and they started having this conversation that led to, well, have you ever had a fantasy about having sex with another person while you're having sex with me? And Christiana said, yes, of course. And he was like, what? Really? And he, I think that Stanley, I'm, this is on me, was emasculated by a frank, honest conversation that he was having with his wife and felt that he needed to go out and do what Tom Cruise does in that film, was to, you know, just to experience something, because Stanley grew up just up the road from here in the Bronx, you know?
Yeah. I mean, he imbued that onto the, I mean, the book, the Dream Story, that he adapted for the film. But, I mean, I think that's a horror movie, you know? I mean, at least for Cruise's character.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah, 100%.
You mentioned Stella Adler, and I never got the pleasure. NYU put me in with Circle in the Square, and I never got to go to Adler. But I've heard you talk about her before, and I'm wondering, how does her teaching still speak to you? Which parts of it do you still relate to, and other parts of it that, like much of method, like much of Stanislavski, just, nope, I don't need that. I need this. I always viewed it as like religion or diets. You take the parts you need and you can safely ignore the rest.
Yeah.
And did she influence you in terms of your commitment to politics as an artist?
She definitely influenced my politics, you know, and how she talked about it all the time, because she had grown up in political theater, you know, whether it was Ibsen or Chekhov or Arthur Miller, that theater was a place of ideas where we get the opportunity to, through language and performance, see somebody looking at life. And, you know, like if you imagine a horse with blinders on his eyes so that it can only see forward, that what the theater had the ability to do was to open those blinders to help us to see the other, to see a different point of view, to experience something. The way that Harper Lee in her book, To Kill a Mockingbird, says that we never truly understand another person till we get inside their skin and move around in it. And by definition, that's what we're doing as performers, is climbing in the skin of these characters and trying to see the other, try to understand that these desires and dreams that we have are universal. Unless you're really some kind of sick person, you don't want to harm another person or kill another person, certainly, that we want to enjoy life. And sometimes there are people, politicians and oligarchs, and that don't care about other human beings and just want to push people down and to be more powerful and you know, and selfish. That's why I made that film Jesus Was a Commie,
which I loved.
You know, thank you, because I just, the most powerful thing I feel that's in that film, and it's the most powerful parable that I've ever read. And I've searched through religious texts before that the concept, the idea of forgiveness, I don't find it before that parable, when he says that those among you that are without sin cast the first stone, that you know, we're all human. We all make mistakes. And the journey is to understand that every day we have, every moment, we have the opportunity to decide who we are and what we want to be, that we can be an asshole in this moment, or we can be a good person. We can be forgiving, or we can punish. We can steal, or we can pay. You know, that we have that ability to make those decisions every second of our life. And so, you know, I know that you're a person who wants to be a good person, and every moment of your life you try to, you know, even through your comedy, through the witty things that you write, that you say, that you're helping us open those blinders on the side and help us to see the world in a different way through humor.
Billy Wilder said, if you're going to tell people the truth, make it funny or they'll kill you. And I tried being preachy. I wasn't any good at it.
Yeah.
I would love to have you back anytime just to talk about politics and the environment and bike riding and spirituality. But I'm so grateful that you came in. I love talking about craft with you and talking about your work. If you haven't seen it yet, what's wrong with you? The fourth season of Stranger Things is streaming now on Netflix. I know you're going to be in Christopher Nolan's film of Oppenheimer coming up, and I can't wait to see what else you do next.
Wow,
Mr.
that's
Modine.
Crazy. Oppenheimer is crazy.
Can you tell us anything?
I can tell you, when I contacted him to ask if I could be a part of the show. He said, well, we're just casting a lot of unknown actors. The only person that anybody knows is Killiam Murphy from Peaky Blinders. And I said, that's okay, Chris. I just really love to be a part of this project and work with you again. And then I found out Matt Damon's in it, Emily Blunt, Gary Oldman, Kenneth Branagh.
Wow.
Did I say Matt Damon?
You did. So maybe it'll get some press.
Robert Downey Jr. Yeah. I mean, it was funny, the bit that he said there was a bunch of unknowns.
That's great. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah. Oh, it's going to be amazing. You know, and the thing that's amazing about it, going back to communism, is do we got to stop?
But they're wrapping us up. I think they're going to steal you from us. But go ahead, please finish your thought.
Because Oppenheimer was a communist, but it was a communist in the sense of Karl Marx and nothing to do with Stalin or Lenin or Mao. It was about the idea of community.
That exactly.
The root of the word is with, and that we are with one another.
Yeah, he was not a totalitarian. Yeah, he actually believed the Jesus-y parts of it.
But then they were willing to turn the government and say, okay, let's not look at that. Let's just look at you have the ability to help us to make this bomb. And then as soon as he made the bomb and they deployed it, of course, then he was a communist again in their eyes, and they chucked him out and just destroyed his life.
I can't wait to see it. Matthew Modine, thank you so much for joining us again. Please come back and let's go even deeper on this stuff.
Okay. Thanks, John.
Thanks a lot.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Let me go to Rich in Denver. Hi, Rich.
Good evening, Mr. John Fugelsang. This is Rich. I met you for the first time in October at the Liberal Comedy Tour in Madison.
Oh, what a pleasure. Yes, thank you.
What a pleasure. I got a photograph with you. I know your mom and my mom were ex-nuns, and so we had a nice little chat about that.
I remember our conversation. And, thank you.
Absolutely. And thank you, John. John, I just got on with Thea, and you were talking about Jamie Lee Curtis in a movie. What movie are you speaking of? Because I am
Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, starring Michelle Yeoh, which is my favorite film of the year, and it's a drama, comedy, sci-fi, farce, satire about parallel universes. I can't even begin to explain it. It's just it's a film that has to be seen.
And it's just out now, then. Or it's
on demand for purchase, not for rental. I bought it, and I will watch it again. It's still playing in theaters. Everything, Everywhere, All at Once.
I will definitely put that on my movie list. Thank you very much.
Trust me on it.
You know, to go back to I think it was Mark in Maryland, and talking about Reagan, Bedtime for Bonzo. You know, another thing he did. another thing he did is he instituted the Reagan tax cuts that were supposed to sunset under Bush. That became the Bush tax cuts that never sunsetted. And, you know, 25,000 of our brothers and sisters were dead of AIDS before that POS ever, you know, opened his mouth. And as you said, he raised taxes 13 times.
He 11, I think.
Social Security taxes. 11 times. Okay.
He taxed Social Security benefits, yeah. Oh, yeah. Reagan. We could talk all day about how the awfulness of Reagan and how we're still paying for it.
And you know, there aren't, I don't know why these people, and the point you made to him is excellent. I don't know why you would still vote for this party. This isn't a party anymore. It's a cult. You know, there are no true conservatives. You know, Tom Hartman has put the bet up several times, and nobody's ever been. Name me one thing that when the cons have had control of the judicial, the executive, and the legislative branches in this country in the last 55 years, what have they done for the American people?
What have they done? I always say, when have they put non-millionaires above millionaires? And I say, name one teaching of Jesus they fought for legislatively. Just one. And no one can do it. Because, as you said, they are a cult. And that's why people continue to vote for them. Because jingoism is a drug. And it is a cult that comes with an IV drip that tells you you're better than other people. And it's why reason doesn't work. Morality doesn't work. And every time they get fucked over by their rulers, they find a way to get them back. They've got fucked over by Bush Cheney, and Donald Trump came along and gave them permission to admit they got fucked over by Bush Cheney, and then they got fucked over by Trump.
And then Chuckle Nuts, Bush Jr. came along, and after we got rid of him, and they'll be saying the same thing about Trump. They all say, well, I never voted for him, you know?
I know. They'll all deny it.
You know, exactly. I mean,
They're all pretending now that they were against the Iraq war. All of them pretending they were against the Iraq war.
75% of the people, yeah, exactly, got hoodwinked into, you know, it's like you said, John, and you're absolutely right when you're talking about, you know, I had a buddy, he said, you know, the people who sing the loudest need the most saving, and they come wrapped in Old Glory and the Bible, you know.
Testify. You're right.
It's just absolutely sickening, and I'll tell you this: on this great day, when Ketanji Jackson Brown gets elected to the Supreme Court, and I know how we can fix this, John, and I think I've mentioned this to you before, we have got to get the money out of politics. There's a video on YouTube with President Harry Truman in 1957, John, being interviewed by Goodnight and Good Luck, who's the great journalist, Edward R. Murrow,
right.
One of the last great journalists, you know, where Cronkite took his teachings from and learned,
right.
You know, and he says to him in that video, John, he says, what do we do about when elections become privately financed or one guy has more money than the other? And Truman says point blank, and this is quote, we're already there. And this is in 1957. Yeah. And what we need to do is when we get everything back, if this is the last elections of our life, you know, it's over if we lose. We need to overturn Citizens United, and we need to make all federal elections publicly financed, John. No Koch brothers money.
Yeah, I agree.
No Sinclair money. That's got to be the priority. And another thing is working on a year from now is to get rid of voting rights, to take it away from the state.
I know it.
That's it, game
over. I know it.
If we don't balance the court. I love you, John.
Game's not over.
You're awesome.
Game's not over.
Awesome.
The struggle will always be going on. When we're old, we'll be in this struggle. We are here to carry the baton for a while and pass it on to the next ones. And I thank you for inspiring me, Rich. We got to take a quick break. We will be right back in a second. Sheila in Texas. Hello.
Hey, John.
Hi.
I wanted to say I miss Tuesday night when everybody was saying something nice about everybody else because I was on Goofers because broke my leg a little bit going to pee in the middle of the night.
I'm good.
I'm just a doofus.
Okay.
That's all.
How do you break your leg a little?
Your leg a little.
Well, I cracked it.
Oh,
but
God.
It hurt like hell.
Yeah.
It really did. Anyway, I was on Goofers, and I really, you know, didn't want to be any goofier than I usually sound. But I wanted to call to say I love the guys that call your show, and I really appreciate their support for their sisters. And I want them to know if the tables were turned, I would go to battle for them, too.
Nice.
I really would. I really appreciate the guys that
you got some.
That
you know
call.
What? Every time I lose faith in these fucking men, I come here, I do the show, and there's so many decent guys who call. I mean, I'm not going to say they redeem the Y chromosome, but still, I'm usually very impressed.
It helps. It helps so much. It really does. You know.
Yep.
But I also wanted to say I've been thinking about these checkpoints that people are speculating about, And I want to tell you that during COVID lockdown, I live pretty close to the Louisiana line, state line, and I-20 runs through here.
Okay.
And during the lockdown and right, I guess, after the vaccinations came out, there was a checkpoint not too far from my home.
Okay.
And they were stopping people, you know, forcing them off the interstate and checking for vaccine cards. And the only people they turned away were black people, and they turned them back to Louisiana. And I was just stunned at the time. But now, you know, in my mind, I can think how this whole abortion thing, going to another state, blah, 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 is going to work out. And they will do it. Don't anybody think they won't do it. They will do it. They do everything on purpose. They're horrible people.
They'll do it until it's too much of a headache for them to do it. It's going to be a very interesting couple of years.
And I want to tell you also, my little sister works as a surgery nurse at a women's hospital. And women every day, all day long, are still having ectopic pregnancies.
That's right.
I think some of the stuff, some of the laws that, I mean, that might put the brakes on some of the stuff are doctors.
Yeah.
Because they're kind of stunned about what can we do, what can we not do, what are you talking about, you know, what the fuck's going on.
That's right.
Is how they're thinking about it. But it's going to it happens 24/7. It's not going to stop, you know. So,
and by the way, but in this battle, doctors are still going to be on the front lines, and they're still going to be the heroes. And there's going to be a lot of doctors who go to jail because they care about women. Thank you so much, Sheila.
Exactly.
Your leg feels better. Have a great weekend.